Mima was a pop star.
This is Mima's last performance with Cham.
Who desired to become an actress.
I really hope that I can entertain you just the same as an actress.
But sometimes, aspirations can be deadly.
I'm always watching Mima's room!
In the world of make-believe.
This is when Mima proves herself.
The price of fame.
Don't worry, Mima, it'll be all right.
May not be worth the cost of identity.
Where did this come from? How do they know so much?
Innocence is lost. Dreams become nightmares. And privacy no longer exists. Where everything you do can be seen by everyone. And those you trust are really those you should fear. Your life no longer belongs to you.
Excuse me.
Mania Entertainment presents Satoshi Kon's animated psychological thriller, Perfect Blue.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 39 of Super Podcast. I'm your super awesome host, Super Marcy. And I think we've got a bit of a mixed bag show this time around, and I'm joined with my guests from, I guess, cold, dreary England. Oh, well, yeah, actually, that's Australia right now, but I'm sure it's like that over there. So welcome back, Sam.
Thank you, Marcy. Nice to be back.
That was a dreadful introduction. I suck. Anyway, it's been a while since I've done the podcast, so I've got to get back into the groove of things. But yeah, we've got a bit of a mixed bag, I guess, because we're covering lots of different topics. And the first topic...
Yeah, a bit of a grab bag of recent topics, isn't it, today?
Yeah. And then to finish it off with, we'll be going back on previous subjects of previous podcasts. But to start off, we're going to talk about a filmmaker who passed away recently, and I'll hand it over to Sam to talk about it because I can't pronounce his name, and I apologise.
Well, as a lot of listeners will already know, on Tuesday there was the very sad news of the passing of anime director Satoshi Kon, who was only 46, passed away of pancreatic cancer. And I wanted to talk about it because he's not tremendously well known. Some of the listeners will have seen films like Perfect Blue or Paprika, which are his two sort of most popular films. But he's, you know, not as well known as somebody like Hayao Miyazaki. I think, yeah, for my money, Satoshi Kon was one of the few visionaries working in cinema. He was, somebody who really used anime and cinema to its fullest potential. You know, created real intricate worlds, often on multiple levels of reality. And I just always looked forward to seeing a new film by him because I knew I was going to be sort of taken on a strange and usually very wonderful journey. So, yeah, it's a terrible shame. And if nothing else, I hope his early passing will, encourage people to discover his films.
Yeah, well, I've only seen Perfect Blue, so I think I'm a bit more aware of him now. So I think I'll have to track down his other films. But Perfect Blue is probably one of my favourite movies, but it's one that I can't really watch often because it has such a strong impact on me.
Yeah, it is a tough film. And actually it's quite typical of his cinema. It's his first film, and originally it was going to be a live action film, actually.
I can't imagine how a live action would work with that film.
But yeah, one of the backers pulled out and they had to go with animation. And I think that's very telling because a lot of Kon's imagery is very live-action-like. Mm. A lot of his shots and choices are more from the live action world than from animation, and that's one of the things that really gives his films a sort of very individual look. And it's also the influences. I mean, on that film, I think you've got a lot of Hitchcock in it, a lot of David Lynch, a lot of Cronenberg.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you know, rather than other animators or even really manga.
Mm.
So I think he's an interesting filmmaker from that perspective.
Mm.
So, yeah, and there is one more film to come, because since 2007 he'd been working on a children's film, actually, called The Dream Machine.
Yeah, okay.
And that is nearly finished, and as I understand, it will be released.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, so we've got one more film to come from the late great Satoshi Kon.
Mm. So, yeah, I mean, if listeners haven't really heard of his stuff or anything, I would definitely recommend Perfect Blue, and I know that now I'm going to have to track down his other movies to watch.
I've already written about Paprika on my Top 100 series at 24fps, and I will be writing about Perfect Blue because that's on the list as well.
I look forward to reading that.
And though it isn't on the list, I can also heartily recommend Millennium Actress, which is a beautiful, beautiful film, you know.
And that's
stunning as well.
Mm, I'll have to check those out. And this is going to not exactly lead us into our next topic. And our next topic for discussion is online criticism or online critics.
Yeah, there was an interesting thing a few weeks ago, a bit of a controversy when a critic called Armand White, who writes, I think, for the New York Post.
I think so.
He was on the Slash Film podcast, and he's become quite notorious as something of a contrarian. And they were talking to him about the state of criticism. And he said two things I thought were actually borderline offensive. And that was, first of all, that Roger Ebert destroyed film criticism.
Yeah, he said
which
that.
Is ludicrous to me.
Yeah.
And also, he said that people under 30 shouldn't be allowed to be film critics.
Yeah, he can
make
his
mouth. Which I took exception to as a 29-year-old film critic. And I mean, how long have you been writing? Because you're what? You're a bit younger than me.
I'll be 26 in a few months.
All right.
I've been writing movie reviews since high school.
So that's, probably 10 years.
You know, like over 10 years. And this, like, my reviews wasn't just, in high school, I was doing it for English assignments. And I was getting top marks for it. So I can't imagine that I'm coming from a bad place.
Mm. I mean, this is what I'm saying. So between us, we're 29 and 25. Mm. And between us, we've got, 22, 23 years of writing movie reviews.
Mm.
But apparently we shouldn't be allowed to have started yet, if you listen to Armand White, because we're not sufficiently educated on film or life or religion or politics, and all of these things that I agree with him do come into reviewing movies and to understanding movies, to understanding anything. But, I think what's offensive is the idea that somebody under 30 can't view things through those prisms.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
contribute anything of worth.
I mean, to me, that's just stupid. Like, it's hard to explain because I don't think it's so much an age being an issue, because people of the same age are on different levels and everybody has their different interests. So when it comes to film in particular, everybody is quite different. But at the same time, I do, even if I don't agree, that everybody has a valid opinion. And, when I want an opinion, I at least want it to be valid. Like, I don't just want someone to say, this movie sucks, end. Tell me why this movie sucks.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, and this is the distinction, that's not a film critic.
Mm.
That's a reviewer. That's somebody who's just telling you something. Mm. A critic is somebody who has an argument and who, you know, takes you through why they have an opinion that they have of a film and backs it up and, you know, discusses it through other things, you know, and makes a coherent argued case for something. I think you do that. I hope I do that.
Well, you do that. And again, I hope I do that.
You know, and that's the thing. I think, to be honest, I'm probably better at it at times than I am at others.
Mm.
I mean, with something like Clash of the Titans, I think I was probably just throwing insults quite a lot of the time. Whereas
with
something like
Antichrist,
that was a much more analytical piece.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, different films are going to have different layers to them. There's different things going on, different motivations. I don't think it matters if you're reviewing something like, I'll just take any kind of movie, say something as ludicrous as Troll 2, to something, you know, very serious as, say, Mulholland Drive. Two completely different things, right? But I think that no matter what the case, you still need to understand, like, where they're coming from, the times that they were made, what they're trying to say, if they're trying to say anything at all.
Yeah.
And then, you know, take that all in and put your own take on what it's about, what you got out of it, how you felt, what you think they were trying to achieve. Make it, like, it has to make sense and it has to be, I guess, valid to the point, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think that's why, to a certain degree, I understand White's argument that a critic should have some degree of film education. It doesn't necessarily, I think, have to be formal, though I actually do have a formal film education. Mm. You know, I have qualifications in film theory, and I know that shit backwards. Mm. You know, so, you know, I have that grounding. And again, onward, I'm under 30. But I don't think you necessarily have to have that. But what you do have to have, I think, as a critic, is some understanding of the history of film and some understanding of the techniques of film, from hand colouring in 1907 to 3D now, you know. Mm. But where I don't agree with Armand White is that you should only start writing the minute that you have all that knowledge, which apparently is at 30.
Apparently.
Because, you know, all writers develop over time. Yeah. I certainly have.
And if you don't,
then you weren't very good to start with.
Yeah, I mean,
but if you're only starting at 30, you're going to be 40 before you're any good.
Yeah. It's taken me a long time to really get where I'm at. But there are times when I'll go through a bad stage and my writing's just not where I want it to be. And at other times it'll be, you know, really in the zone, and it's just, I just feel like I can't do any wrong, I'm doing everything right. But it takes time to develop, and you need to learn these things. You need to experience different films, different, like, you know, different genres, different time periods, everything. But I don't think that is something that needs to be restricted by somebody's age.
No, I mean, actually, for me, I think the sooner you start doing that, the better you will be as a film critic. I think at the end of the day, the one absolute incontrovertible requirement for being a film critic, the only thing I would say you absolutely must have, is a love of cinema. You've got to love it. You've got to, you know, be excited by it. And as grumpy as I can be about it, and I can be very, very grumpy about it, as we'll probably see later, I love cinema, and I am constantly, you know, searching and yearning for the next great thing. And that's what keeps me going with it, and that's what makes me good at it, if I am good at it.
Yeah.
You know? And you can't start developing that early enough.
Yeah, exactly.
For my money. I mean, I met a little kid on a train recently with his mother, they were just sitting opposite me and they were talking about movies and, you know, wanting to see Inception. And I said, well, I've just come back from Inception, actually. And she said, oh, what did you think? And you know, I mentioned that I parted company with the rest of the world on it.
Much.
But that, you know, I hadn't thought much of it, but everyone else did. And, you know, I said that I was a film critic. You should have seen this kid's eyes light up.
Yeah.
You know, somebody gets to do that? And it was like meeting the 10-year-old me. You know, and if I'd met a film critic. So, you know, and that was brilliant to see a kid so young who was clearly so switched on to movies and so excited about them. And, you know, by the time he's 15, he's going to be writing really good movie reviews too.
That kind of reminds me almost of when I was that age, but it was more like, even at that age, I'd be getting asked, what's good to see? What are you looking forward to seeing? And,
yeah,
you know, in my young teens, like at the video store before we had DVDs, I'd be in there and I'd see someone pick up a movie and I'd be like, you don't want to watch that. And they'd be like, why? And I'd explain, I'd give my verbal review of the movie and they'd put it back, grab something else, which I'd recommended. And I was almost tempted to, like, ring me if he hated it and I'll never do it again. But, you know, even the people that worked there would be like, okay, what did you like this movie? Have you seen this movie? And I'd be like, yeah, this is what I think of this one, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, everybody's like, you should just, like, work there and recommend movies to people. I'm like, yeah, maybe, if they paid me.
Yeah.
Although,
I love that feeling, and I get it on my blog as well sometimes. You know, I got a nice comment on my Bluebeard review that, you know, it had prompted somebody to, you know, give a filmmaker some reconsideration, Catherine Breyer, some reconsideration, you know, because I'd given the film a glowing review and said that it was really interesting and different. And, you know, that's just a great feeling, the idea that, you know, because somebody, you know, respects your opinion, that, you know, they'll change their viewing habits maybe. And that's great, and that's why we do it.
Yeah.
You know, certainly that's why I got into
it. Well, yeah, the one thing that I really appreciate is even if people don't agree with my opinion, it gets respected. And they're not going to say, you're a dickhead for not liking this movie, or you're a dickhead for liking this movie. It's like, yeah, okay, fair enough, you don't like this movie, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but at least there's still that there, and, you know, there's no hate going on. And I think when you get told, yeah, I don't agree with your opinion, but you know, you put up a good argument as to why you liked it, didn't like it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I think when you can write something well, that's what's going to happen. And, you know, reading this, going back to Mr. White's reviews, I just cannot get through one of his reviews, and I just cannot respect this guy all that much.
Well, for me, I mean, he's clearly an intelligent critic. He clearly knows what he's talking about, and I don't think he's a contrarian either, which is something that he's been accused of. I think he clearly absolutely believes everything he writes. I just think he's sort of misapplying the knowledge that he has and that he's, you know, just very wrong-headed. He seems to think that every film demands, you know, the in-depth analysis that he is suggesting that you can't give until you're in your 30s. And, you know, something like Transformers 2, I mean, yes, there are clear subtexts to it. I think he's interpreting it wrongly when he says that it's about our relationship to machinery. You know, I don't see that in it.
No.
I think if it's about anything, it's about robots punching each other and jingoism. Mm. But, you know, those are two different opinions. But he goes to such extremes with the film theory on that film, and it doesn't really stand up to that scrutiny. As far as I'm concerned, there's not enough thought that's gone into it as a film.
I think that, like, with some things, he's going, like, way too much into it and almost inventing his own world where it's like, yeah, but that's not really the right thing. But I just, you know, trying to read what he's writing, I just can't get through it.
There's a certain point at which analysis becomes actually rewriting the film. And I think Almond White quite often crosses that point, certainly in his Toy Story 3 review, which is one of the most bafflingly wrong-headed things I have ever read online. I mean, suggesting that Toy Story 3 is a hymn to product placement is, to me, complete insanity.
But he's the one who watched Transformers 2.
Well, exactly. You know, if Transformers 2 is about our relationship to technology, then surely Toy Story 2 is about what it is actually about, which is our relationship to the stuff of our lives and our emotional connection to it. That's what that film's about, not product placement. And, you know, if Transformers 2 is not about product placement and is about our relationship to something, I don't see how Toy Story 3 can be interpreted as not being about, you know, an emotional relationship. That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, if he can back it up, brilliant. Okay, fine. It's his opinion, but it just strikes me as so wrong-headed that he's sort of misapplying all that knowledge that he brings to something. But that's, you know, the personal taste of what he thinks about movies isn't really the point. The point is more that he seems to think that the opinion of somebody younger, however interested or not they are in cinema, isn't valid. And I just think that's completely, I mean, first of all, crazy, and second of all, offensive.
Pretty much. And I think he's, you know, it's hard for me to explain. He's like almost, because I just recently now just, you know, got refreshed with some of his stuff, but it almost feels like he's in his own little world. And it's like, okay. And it's almost like reading what he has to write, he thinks his opinion is, you know, that's it. Okay.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's an unfair criticism, because I think as a critic, you've got to think that to a certain degree.
I don't know.
Yeah, he's got to believe that you're right.
Well, everybody thinks they're right, but I'm always open to other opinions, but he just gives me the vibe that he's not, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think a good example is one of the best critics I've ever read, nobody will have heard of, because he's just a guy on our boards, actually, at Joblo. Oren Monotremi. I still can't pronounce that name. So sorry, Oren, if I'm pronouncing that wrong. But I almost never agree with him about movies. But the guy always has a way of making me think about something differently. I mean, and making me think, okay, is he right about this? Is this actually more or less interesting than I thought? And that's what a great critic does. I think he's a spectacular writer. And again, he's younger than me too, I believe. So, you know, as I say, it just strikes me as so wrong-headed.
Yeah. And before we continue, I just wanted to send a little mention to, because the day after you mentioned we do this podcast, I had a message from one of the listeners. He goes by, I think it's Optimus Prime 24 on the Joblo forums and MFC, and he's like, I think you should do a podcast on this, and it was exactly the same thing that you had brought up. So I thought, you know, still mention, give him a mention, because it was a really good suggestion. Yeah, it was a good suggestion, and it's funny that we had, you know, the day before you had mentioned it as well. So, yeah, I mean, thanks for, you know, giving me the suggestion, even though we'd already thought of it. But, you know, feels like we're on the right same wavelength as the listeners as to what they want. So
It's always good.
It's always good. So again, thanks very much. It's always very appreciated, and he always gives very positive feedback to all the shows. So it's very nice too. Ta-da. But I think that's probably a bit of a wrap for that subject, unless you've got any closing things to say.
No, I think that's pretty much covered it.
Yeah, so we shall move on and be critics.
I will say just one thing. Oh, yeah. I wrote a Cinematters post on Armand White's appearance on the Slash Filmcast, and obviously you can read that at my site.
And I'll post a link directly to that article on the podcast page.
Cool.
Yeah, anyway, now we're going to be critics. We'll talk about some recent releases that we've both seen. And I think we'll start with one that I liked and you hated, which would be The Expendables.
Yes.
I haven't actually written a review yet. That seems to be something I'll write this review like 3 months from having seen the movie.
Yeah, I was hoping to read your review, to be honest. I'm looking forward to that.
But, you know, to me, I switched off and I had fun watching this movie where things were getting blown up, people were fighting each other. I almost just didn't care what the story was, but at the same time I was confused as to what was going on. But I don't know, maybe I like Stallone too much, or... you know, Statham was just being his usual self, that I just really liked it and I had fun with the movie.
Yeah, I mean, let me be clear that I didn't expect high art from The Expendables. I didn't even really expect a story, and certainly it didn't deliver on either of those. But what I was expecting is cool action, and that's why I hated it, because the action... is some of the worst that I have seen in years. I genuinely think it is all but unwatchable, because the editing is, as I put it in my written review, an offence to God and man. it's like they've just thrown the footage at a room full of monkeys and allowed them to put it together in any way they wanted. I mean, as long as it's fast cut, it seems to be fine. It doesn't matter that you can't tell lots of the time who's actually fighting who. I mean, there's a fight in the last reel where Randy Couture is fighting some bad guy. I think it's Steve Austin, actually. And I thought it was Jet Li who was fighting Steve Austin. And I was genuinely shocked when it turned out to be Randy Couture. And that's purely down to the fact that it was edited so badly that I couldn't see who was fighting.
Yeah, the end, like, towards the end, I will agree, it was a little bit confusing at times, but I still rather enjoyed what I was watching, and I think, like, my favourite fight ended up being the Dolph versus Jet Li, even though it wasn't that spectacular. I just thought it was well done and interesting. That's closest
to being a good fight. And that's because he got Curry Yunque in to help choreograph it. And there is some actual technique going on there. And again, it's almost completely obscured by the editing, and the shooting, which is almost entirely close up and very, very fast slam bang cut. So, I mean, if you watch something that shoots and edits martial arts properly, like, I don't know, Iron Monkey or Chocolate, to take a recent example, you'll actually be able to see the technique, and you can see the performer's whole body most of the time, because it's this choreographed dance of violence. And that's what that scene should be, because if you're hiring Jet Li, that's what you're hiring. You're not hiring an actor, for God's sake. And you can't see it in that scene. And that's why I was so pissed off with it, because I mean, what else is there in that film other than the action? And if you can't enjoy the action, what's the fucking point of the movie?
Well, I enjoyed the action. I mean, obviously, you know, we see it very differently, but I wasn't expecting much. I was just wanting a good time, and I think it delivered on it. But, you know, someone asked me what I preferred, if I preferred The Expendables or the last Rambo movie, just in comparison to, you know, the last two things Stallone did. But at first I thought maybe it was this, but I don't know. I kind of feel differently now, but I just
I frankly loathed both of them. I mean, I would probably give... No, I can't give the edge to either of them. They're both equally piss awful. maybe Rambo is more offensive because it's trying to say something and saying it so reprehensibly poorly. But I can't really say that either of them impressed me in any way, shape, or form.
I guess, I don't know, I guess I enjoyed maybe the ensemble that was there because I like, you know, most of the people in the movie.
It's just grunting in various accents, though.
Well, try
listening to Sylvester Stallone and Dolph Lundgren talk.
Well, it was more like, I can't argue with that, but I'm used to Stallone. I'm used to his I don't do it very well, but I don't know. I had fun, and I did get a really good giggle out of the Bruce Willis and Schwarzenegger scene. It was so typical.
Been more pedestrianly shot, though.
Oh, it was so typical, but it was so funny.
There's one sort of good line in that, which is directed at Schwarzenegger. But again, even that was done better previously. There's a much better joke about Arnie's presidential ambitions in Demolition Man.
Yeah, and I watched that the other day, and I'd forgotten that was in there.
Such a great film. I love Demolition Man. It's one of the few Stallone films I can actually really embrace because, again, it's so much a satire. You know, I would stack it up with something like Robocop. It's not quite as great as Robocop, but it's got a similar idea in that it's so clearly a satire and really works that way.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if The Expendables had had a satirical bone in its body, it might have been entertaining. But instead it's just noisy and stupid and unwatchable. I think it's one of the worst films of the year, and I would encourage everybody to avoid it with extreme prejudice.
No problemo. So do we move on to the next movie to be discussed?
Sure.
Okay. We're going to talk about Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
And I think we're much more together on this one, aren't we?
I think so. I quite enjoyed this movie. I haven't, read the graphic novels or comics or whatever they are now. So I wasn't really familiar with any of that. But the main appeal, I think, was it sounded like a really cool idea and Edgar Wright was behind it. And I'm a big fan of his previous two films. So definitely looking forward to what he was going to do next. And this was completely different to his other two films. So
I've got a mixed record with Edgar Wright. I really liked Shaun of the Dead, certainly. I wasn't a big fan of Hot Fuzz. You know, I was that guy who didn't really like Hot Fuzz very much. Just didn't get me, really. But I did like Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. I liked it rather a lot, with the exception of one kind of central thing that was off for me. But the rest of it I thought was pretty terrific, actually. Really as entertaining a film as I've seen since Kick-Ass, certainly.
Mm.
And
it was fun.
As much fun as I've had in a cinema for a while.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. My experience was just stupid teenagers in the theatre. I mean, why pay the money if you're going to act like a douchebag? You can act like a douchebag outside.
Well, quite. And certainly I had a little bit of that as well. But, you know, surprisingly, again, it didn't kind of take away from the film. To give people a little background on it, because this one actually does have a story. it's about a guy called Scott Pilgrim, played by Michael Cera. He's an unemployed musician. And early in the film, he starts dating the girl of his dreams. The girl of, let's be honest, many, many geeks' dreams. Ramona Flowers, played by the lovely Mary Elizabeth Winstead. And in order to be with her, he has to fight her seven evil exes. Defeat her seven evil exes. Yeah. So, you know, you get a lot of video game-inspired martial arts battles sprinkled throughout the film, along with this sort of, you know, teen romance narrative. Mm. And I thought they meshed actually surprisingly well. The one thing I will say, and again, in contrast with The Expendables, I thought the martial arts was pretty fantastic. And you can really tell that the Jackie Chan stunt team worked on the film because the martial arts is just so fluent and it's really nicely shot.
It was a lot of fun.
So those scenes really held up for me.
Yeah, me too. Everything was a lot of fun, and it had, you know, quirky characters and just, you know, mostly likable characters.
I really like the visuals. I really like the characters. Mm. You know, the side characters, even Alison Pill as the drummer in Scott's band. Mm. She's really funny. I don't know why we don't see her much more, Alison Pill. I've liked her in what I've seen her in. And actually, the two sort of blandest characters are the central ones. It's the side characters, Alison Pill, Ellen Wong as Knives Chow, Patrick Fugit in that lovely bit part as young Neil. You know, and things like that. They're kind of the colour in the movie, and the evil exes, of course. Mm. Notably, Mae Whitman, who has a killer opening line to Scott, which is lovely. But the two sort of central characters, Scott and Ramona, are blander, I think.
Yeah, I think Scott especially, and you know, I just found Michael Cera as Scott Pilgrim to just be very annoying. I don't know if the character is meant to be annoying, but I was annoyed for the most part.
Yeah, for me, he's the big hole at the centre of the film.
Mm.
I thought he was irritating. And also, I thought he was just Michael Cera again.
He was Michael Cera playing
the same performance he gave in Juno. It's the same performance he gave in Superbad. It's the same performance he gave in Youth in Revolt. And, you know, name a Michael Cera film.
In everything he's ever done, he's the same thing.
And, you know, that's not actually such a terrible thing. In a way, because, you know, Cary Grant never played anyone but Cary Grant, but with the best will in the world, Michael Cera is not Cary Grant. And, yeah, he's just he's whiny and irritating. I mean, I think the line that kind of made me want to slap him hardest was his roommate, played by Kieran Culkin, who, again, is really great.
He's really good, yeah.
He says that Scott should break up with his current girlfriend, Knives, before he starts going out with Ramona. Yeah, fair enough.
Mm.
And Scott's reply is, but it's hard.
Yeah. You're so whiny. And so, like, the same. It's so annoying.
Yeah, I mean, that was the moment where I just wanted to punch him. But I've got to say, and I think you didn't share this, I totally understood why you would want to fight seven evil exes for Ramona Flowers.
Oh, it's not because, that. Like, you one look at her, she's hot.
You know, I mean,
she seems cool.
Yeah, that is
a
red-blooded male.
But I don't think it was fleshed out enough.
No, totally. And it is a shallow relationship. But at the end of the day, they're 22.
Yeah.
You know, who doesn't have shallow relationships at the age of 22?
It's more along just like, okay, he's totally into her, but she kind of maybe likes him. Like, you know, it's just a bit, okay.
And again, what 22-year-old doesn't know that? You know? certainly that felt familiar to me. That, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, and maybe I'm giving away a bit much about myself here, I could definitely identify with Scott in a lot of ways. And maybe that's why he irritated me a lot as well.
Oh, definitely.
Because it's like, shit, I was that guy at some point, you know?
Oh, yeah, I've been that, you know, that person too. It's like, okay, I totally dig in someone, but they don't really like me that much.
Yeah.
But, you know, being in that situation, I probably wouldn't go and fight their seven evil exes. If they didn't like me that much, I'd move on and focus on someone that did.
I don't know enough video games to do that kind of martial arts, but I think I'd be tempted if it were Mary Elizabeth Winstead, I've got to say. My ass handed to me, but you know, I'd be tempted to try.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't turn down going out with her either.
You just made a lot of podcast listeners very happy.
Oh, well, she's hot. Although Bede will probably have something to say about it. He'd fight us both for her, I'm sure.
I've got to say, I do find her very charming as a screen presence. You know, there's just something about her.
Yeah.
Even with such a thin character as Ramona, she's she's a movie star, certainly. And there's just something there that this sort of inherent charm, this inherent charisma that really comes off the screen very nicely, I think. And that's another reason that you can kind of get behind it, even if the relationship isn't very filled in and the character is very thin.
Yeah.
And it's got to be said, she also has an amazing fight with Mae Whitman.
That's
a fantastic fight. That's probably my favourite martial arts moment in the film with, you know, Winston with the big hammer.
It was just a lot of fun. I liked, you know, a lot of the video game stuff, like the coins and the, you know, extra lives and stuff like that.
I was glad it was kind of all from the 8-bit era because, you know, that's kind of the 8 and 16-bit era is kind of my era when I was playing video games. I haven't played a new video game in over 10 years.
Yeah. It helps because that's the most fun I've had was, you know, back in those days of the video games.
I got a lot of that reference, even though I'm not a gamer, which I think you probably want to be in order to get the most out of Scott Pilgrim.
Mm. Yeah. And I think the other really good, well, fun, good part with some of the evil exes were, you know, just very strange and quirky characters. And I really liked Chris Evans as Lucas Lee. He was
My favourite was Brandon Routh.
He was definitely my favourite.
So funny.
He was really good.
I've got a lot of time for him as a comedian, actually. He was really great in Zack and Miri as well, which I thought was a pretty terrible film, but he was really good in it. Mm. I think, you know, fuck another Superman movie. Give that guy a comedy vehicle.
He's actually been really, really good in the TV show Chuck, which it's one of my favorite, you know, fun shows. And he kind of plays like, it is a bit of a comical role. He kind of plays like the good and bad guy, and he just does it so well. And he just kind of came off in this movie just so perfectly. I totally would not be with Scott Pilgrim, I'd totally be with Todd. That was his character's name.
Well, Todd's not really my thing, but yeah, he certainly was very funny.
Mm. And the whole, I won't give away the little cameos that are in there, but the vegan police were hilarious.
That got one of the biggest laughs in my screening, certainly. I think I was one of the few people who kind of got those cameos.
Mm.
But they were lovely. Yeah.
It was good.
That was some great stuff.
Yeah, and what's his name? Jason Schwartzman was just very greasy and sleazy.
Yeah, he's beautifully arrogant.
You know,
as Gideon.
It was perfect. It's just like, oh, Scott, would you just like kick his ass, please?
I think my other complaint about the film is probably the music, that they dwell a bit much on some of the music. Some of those sequences are a bit long for what they are. And I think the only really decent music in the film is, and as much as I hate to say it, because they're meant to be the sort of crass commercial band, I think the Clash of Demonhead stuff is probably the best.
Yeah, I'd quite like it.
And that's largely because that song on the soundtrack, that's a Metric record. I really like Metric, so. But Sex Bob-omb, ugh, I hate that name.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, if I've got this theory about music that you can tell quite a lot of time how good a band are going to be by how good their name is. Sex Bob-omb fucking suck. And, you know, as much as you would expect from their name. Beck wrote the songs and apparently was told that they should be somewhere between awful and awesome. Unfortunately, the accent fell on awful for me, and frankly, it dwelled on them a bit much. But, you know, if you like that stuff, then, you know, that'll work much better for you. It wasn't really for me, just on a musical level.
Yeah, so I guess that's Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would certainly suggest that people go out and see it. I think it's well worth seeing. It's probably, for me, just outside my top 10 of the year so far.
Yeah, I haven't really come up with any kind of list, but it'd definitely be one of the more...
Otherwise, I'll forget stuff.
It's definitely one of the more enjoyable ones, and it is fun, so there's nothing wrong with giving it a try. What else are we going to talk about? I wanted to quickly bring up... a film that's just got released here, but it's been out in your neck of the woods for a while, I think.
I saw it actually on a preview with a Q&A with the director.
The Killer Inside Me, which is definitely coming off as very controversial.
And frankly, I'm as baffled about that controversy as Michael Winterbottom seems to be.
Because
it's not an especially violent or even a very exploitative. But the scenes that it's focusing on, the controversy, are not the scenes that bothered me, I've got to say.
Yeah, from what I'd heard and then what I saw, I'm just like, okay. Maybe I've seen too many movies to not really have this thing have this effect on me, but there were other elements that I found a lot more disturbing. But it's not, you know, hearing people walking out in disgust, I mean, this movie didn't have that effect on me at all.
Well, I mean, it got started at Sundance this year when the first question in the Q&A essentially wasn't a question, but a woman who got up and essentially said, how dare you make this film and how dare Sundance screen it? And I mean, I understand the sentiment to a certain degree because it is a film that is frequently about violence against women. But the moments that the controversy is focused on are the moments when, I mean, I won't reveal the second one, but the first one happens quite early in the film and has been talked about a lot,
I think we're pretty safe to mention that.
Is the moment when Casey Affleck beats Jessica Alba's character to death. And it is tough. And there is a moment towards the end when you see her face and it essentially resembles hamburger. But what's really clever about the way that Michael Winterbottom directs that sequence is that most of it is actually on Casey Affleck. You don't see Jessica Alba's face very much in that scene. And most of the punches, of which there are many, it has to be said, are played on Casey Affleck.
There's a lot of it, you know, as well, the sound of it happening as well.
And that's why I think people have been disturbed by it, because the sound has made them think that they've seen more than
yeah,
they do.
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of like, I think, the effect of, say, you know, how going back to something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how people were saying how brutal and bloody it was, but there is hardly any blood in it. It's just, I think, the way it's been done, you just, your brain interprets it as something else.
And even further back to the shower scene in Psycho. You know, it's the same thing that Hitchcock was doing with that. And yet, Winter Blossom's use of the violence in that scene and the other key scene, which has just one punch in it and is, I think, probably the most, the best sequence in the film because it's so nasty and so transgressive and disturbing. You know, that's the scene where I think the film really works.
I mean, I thought it was a good film. It was a strange film because your central character is a killer and there's just a lot of very strange motivations and it's very, I guess it's kind of a little bit intricate as to why he's doing what he's doing and particularly to these people. And they kind of touch a little bit on, you know, how he's come to be this way, but there's a lot of, you know, the relationship between sex and violence. And it's been done many times before, and I've seen it many times in film, but, you know, in this case it is really in your face as to
and that's subject. The thing that I find quite puzzling, that none of the controversy is really focused on that aspect of the film, because it is a film that binds up violence against women with sexuality almost inextricably. And those are the sequences, the flashback sequences, that I did find somewhat offensive, actually, at times, because I don't know that they really illuminate very much, and they are really just scenes that are sexual violence against women to little discernible purpose. And that I do find a little disturbing and a little offensive.
It is a tough film to kind of dissect, I guess.
I can't say I liked it. I certainly appreciated it. I think it's well crafted. I don't know that Michael Winterbottom has ever made an uninteresting film. He's made bad ones, but I don't know that he's ever made one that is dull. And certainly The Killer Inside Me isn't that. It's got a fantastic central performance from Casey Affleck and some really nice supporting work. And Bill Pullman comes in and nicks a couple of scenes towards the end.
For his scenes, I was just like, that man has got it.
Yeah, it was, I mean, good stuff. I like him. And Elias Koteas as well.
Oh, I would totally just marry him right now. I just completely love that guy.
I think he's a pretty spectacular actor.
He's an amazing actor. I think he's a very underrated actor. And his performance was really, you know, I thought it was just really fantastic in this movie.
Just very, very nice and very subtle. Among the women, I think they're actually given quite short shrift. I thought Jessica Alba was pretty poor. But Kate Hudson, I think, does her best work for some time.
Yeah, I agree about Kate. She was really good. And, you know, almost didn't recognize her because it's so different.
And it's interesting because I never really saw her in that sort of role. She's got a bit of a sort of femme fatale thing going on here, certainly in the look. And I think that really helps with the performance because she doesn't look like herself very much.
Yeah, and it almost looked like she'd put on a bit of weight as well. And I think that kind of suits her because she looked pretty good.
Yeah, but yeah, I think it's good work from her, and yeah, there's a lot of good work in a film that I can't say I liked, and I can't say I'd really recommend.
It's a hard movie to recommend.
Many good things about it.
It's a hard movie to recommend, but I'm the kind of person that goes for these kind of movies. What can I say?
I will say one thing as well. It has the best title sequence of the year.
Oh, I loved it. It was fantastic.
Hands down.
Oh.
It's got a really
as soon as
cool
it comes on, it's just
retro,
like, oh.
Retro 70s title
sequence.
Yeah,
it is really good. It's just like, oh, this is cool.
That might be my favourite thing in the movie, actually.
Mm. Yeah, it was pretty cool. I think my favourite thing was probably Elias, because he's such a great actor. Anytime I see him in a movie, I just go gaga.
Yeah, you got to love the guy. He's fantastic.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, those are the few films that we're going to talk about, but we're going to go back in time to previous podcasts to discuss some other films that I've seen recently. One film we talked about, I think it was on our the first time you came on the podcast.
Yeah.
I think it was episode 27, Why Haven't You Seen These Films? Since then, you did kind of, order me, but as part of the the blogathon.
I ordered you to watch Dogtooth.
Yeah, you pretty much ordered me to watch Dogtooth, which was, I think, the first film you discussed on your picks of kind of more obscure movies. So I managed to see that, and now I've seen another one, which is Valerie and Her Week of Wonders, which you actually sent me a copy of.
It's a film that I feel like I have a duty to press on people because so few people have seen it, and it is so strange and wonderful.
I've got to say, it's one of the strangest movies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I quite understood everything that was going on, but
I've seen it 4 times. I don't think I do.
Yeah, I really need to watch it a few more times. But I kind of got the idea that it is definitely a coming of age for a young girl, because she's what, 13, and you know, it's coming of age, entering, you know, getting into, it's crossing a line between being a child and, you know, moving on to the adult stage. And
well, like films like Carrie and Ginger Snaps, the whole plot is kind of predicated on her having her first period.
Yeah. And there's a lot of sexual stuff in this movie, so it's kind of like, I guess, like I said, kind of crossing that barrier with those kind of things, but even a bit of a sexual awakening, like she's discovering all these different things now, and, you know, she's no longer a child, I guess.
Yeah,
it kind of made me think, you know, maybe she kind of wants to move on from that, but she still kind of wants to hold on to, you know, being a child, if that makes sense.
Well, she wants to hang on to her grandmother, certainly, and there's still clearly a connection to her father, even though her father may be a vampire.
Yes.
So that's not massively clear.
No, a lot of it's
nothing's
not clear.
Nothing's massively clear. Mm.
It's like Alice in Wonderland took a massive amount of hallucinogen drugs.
Yeah,
it is. Absolutely. It's very Alice in Wonderland like. But you know, it is confusing because there's one character. Is it her boyfriend? Is it her brother? I don't understand. He keeps changing.
I mean, I think there's a possibility that it's both.
It is possible. It is very strange.
I think that's probably true, but I mean, again, it's not clear, and that's the thing. It is. I think the whole film is, to a large degree, a dream.
Mm. Definitely felt that.
Definitely feel that. I mean, particularly the scene where she's taken to be burned as a witch, I think is very much sort of dealing in the surreal. And the way that the same actress plays her mother, her grandmother, and her aunt, a clearly very young actress as well. And the makeup she wears as the grandmother is one of the strangest things.
It really is. You know, a bit of background on this movie. It's from 1970, I believe. And it was a Czechoslovakian film.
Yeah.
If I'm correct.
Yeah, and there was a big sort of surrealist movement in Czechoslovakia at that time.
Well, you can definitely see that.
And Jaromír Jiráš was very much a part of that.
Yeah, you definitely can feel that with the movie. Yeah, it's something I think You know, it's not like I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. It's kind of an in-between where it's this really strange thing. But I think the thing that almost turned me off a little bit is just I really wanted to have more of a grasp with it. But I think I will the more times that I watch it.
Yeah,
it reminds me very much
and,
of
and I think it,
David Lynch.
It is a film that has its own particular feeling, and it does draw you into a world, I think.
Mm, yeah, it feels very like David Lynchian style.
Have you seen The Wicker Man, the original?
I was going to say, well, I did see the great Nicolas Cage performance recently. I haven't seen the original for quite a while.
I think that's probably the film that Valerie is closest to for me in feeling.
Mm.
You know, it has that same sort of otherworldly feel, and it's got the sexuality is all over The Wicker Man as well. And, yeah, that same sort of sense of threat about it as well.
Mm.
But you're never sure what that threat is. I think, yeah, I think it's a tremendously interesting film, and yeah, it is something that I think rewards repeat viewings.
Yeah,
definitely.
I'll definitely.
I can't promise that you'll understand it more.
No,
again, I don't. But you know, I always get something new out of it, and I think it's at only 72 minutes as well.
Yeah,
you know,
it's not very long.
It's not like it takes long out of your life to sit down and see this very strange and very interesting thing. And at the very least, people won't have seen anything like it before.
Mm. I definitely want to have a look at it again, but I think I'll give it a bit of time before I do.
Mm.
But yeah,
oh, yeah,
definitely interesting. Nice to see something completely unexpected, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you at least got something out of it, certainly.
Yeah, definitely not disappointed, I'll say that. One of the other films that you mentioned, which I haven't been able to actually track down, but I do really want to see, was Requiem, the... I think that was the Possession...
It's a German film.
Yeah, Exorcist-type movie.
Yeah,
so
I mean, it's,
I'm
like
still
said,
trying to get through your list.
It's based on the same true story as The Exorcism of Emily Rose was.
Yeah, so I'm still trying to make my way down your list, so...
Cool.
Yeah,
I really want to hear, since you also picked a Lucas Moodysson film, I really want to hear your take on fucking Ammo.
Yeah, I've got it. I just haven't gotten around to watching it with the million other things I've got. I'll be
really interested to know what you think of that.
Yeah, at least that one I managed to get a hold of.
You also saw something recently, didn't you, that AJ absolutely hated?
Yes, I did, which we have to bring up on our Stinkers of the 90s, which was, I think, episode 34, which had me, you, AJ and Bede, and AJ named the number one stinker of the 90s for him as being Lawn Dogs. And you and he had a bit of a discussion about it because you quite liked the movie. And he couldn't even finish the movie.
And I pretty much exploded, as I recall.
your reaction was quite shocking. I had heard of the movie, but I hadn't seen it. But now that I've watched it, I think maybe I had seen it before because it felt very familiar. But I thought it was quite a good movie. I don't understand AJ's hatred for it. I don't think he gave it enough of a chance, I think.
Well, first of all, I think he's not qualified to comment on it because he didn't finish watching it. And I'm sorry, I'm very, very serious about this. If you didn't finish watching a movie, you have no business commenting on it. Mm. I think it's a really, just a lovely film. Some really great performances. Misha Barton, in particular, I think is wonderful. Mm. And some scenes that really stick out, that lovely scene where they compare their scars is, I think, particularly enchanting. Mm. And it's, again, it's got kind of a strange feel, and there's something that's off about it, which I like, because, I don't know, it's just something different, certainly.
Mm. It's... It's a strange movie, but it's, you know, it did anger me just the way that the character of Trent got treated by everybody, because these people that live in this area just so think they're better than everybody else.
Mm. I mean, and the central thread of the film, obviously, is this friendship between a 22-year-old gardener, played by Sam Rockwell, and a 10-year-old girl, played by Misha Barton. And, you know, as an older person, you can understand why that is perhaps troubling.
Mm. But what you see of it,
it's so obviously innocent.
It's still not like that at all. And they're, you know, the one person that these people trust is actually just, you know, the disgusting pervert that they seem to think that Trent is, which he actually isn't.
Yeah.
There's, you know, a bit of a, I mean, I found it a bit disturbing, a scene that takes place in the garage.
Yes, that's very tough, yeah.
Not just with that, but you can see that this girl is very troubled, and the only person who just seems to give her any time of day ends up being, you know, Trent, the Sam Rockwell character. And, of course, it's all just misconstrued completely by, you know, the family and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what AJ was getting at with one or two scenes. There is that odd moment where she strips and goes and howls on the roof, which I still don't understand.
I think that's just crazy 10-year-old behaviour.
I still think you could lose that. And actually it would be a slightly more comfortable film if you did, because naked 10-year-old, you know.
Yeah, no, thank you.
And there's no real need for that. And the other scene where they're kind of dancing on the top of his truck to Bruce Springsteen, and that whole scene as well about the conversation about pissing yourself and stuff, and it's just like,
It seems to come out of nowhere. Can't really get
behind that dialogue.
It comes out of nowhere, and I'm just like, okay, right here.
But those are isolated things, and as a whole, I think the movie is generally pretty brilliant, actually. And it's, like I say, it's got that a sort of particular feel to it, and performances are terrific. Even Christopher McDonald, I think, who's, you know, made a career since Thelma and Louise, are playing complete assholes. He's in Flubber, I think, in which he's I saw this on the Nostalgia Critic review. He's like the biggest asshole in cinema in Flubber.
Yeah.
He comes along as the villain and announces to Robin Williams, when he's asked, "Why are you here?" He says, "Well, to be honest, I'm here this weekend to steal your fiance and make her my wife." You know, that's an impressive bastard.
Yeah, I mean, he's quite perfectly cast in this movie.
But he does it much more realistically in this movie. And
yeah,
you can understand the guy as well.
Mm.
You know, he's not just an asshole in this movie. Mm. He's a genuinely concerned parent.
Well, he wants to protect his daughter.
There are layers to that. Yeah,
he wants to protect his daughter, but he obviously, like, he doesn't understand what's happened. And from his point of view, you can understand why he would get this idea.
And that's why I think the film is so interesting, because there are, you know, those layers to it. And you can see it from each of the characters' points of view.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, I think number one stinker of the 90s, I mean, that's just so...
No. AJ, you really need to watch this movie properly.
And all the way through.
Exactly. I mean, like, you know, Sam Rockwell is easily one of my favourite actors, and he was just so great in this movie.
He is terrific in it, and yeah, really an underrated actor. underrated presence.
Yeah, I think he's one of the, you know, biggest underrated actors. He's just so good in everything he does.
I think we've got one more to talk about, haven't we?
I don't know. Was that it? I can't remember.
I thought you had a list.
No, I had a list in my mind, but that's all I remembered. I think we've discussed everything we wanted to discuss.
Well.
So, yeah, I think that's a wrap.
Awesome.
So, yeah, well, that's a wrap for number 39, and I think unless I have time between the recording of this and when I leave for my trip, I think the next episode 40 will be after my trip. So there'll be a bit of, I think there'll be a bit of a 2 week break or so from being able to record. So, yeah, I think that'll do it. And hopefully the listeners have enjoyed the show, and I'll have some links up on the page where you can check out some of the things that we've talked about. So, yeah, I think that's about it. Thanks for joining me for the show.
Cheers, Marcy.
Always a pleasure to have you on.
Always a pleasure, yeah.
It's always good to have the Australian and the British dude have a banter.
Yep.
Yeah.
Always fun.
So, yeah, until next time, Sam has been English and I've been Australian. Ciao.
If we're going to date, you may have to defeat my 70 mil exes. You have 70 mil ex boyfriends?
Bingo. Consider our fight begun.
And I have to find defeat. Defeat your 70 mil exes? Pretty much.
Prepare to die.
What?
What's up? How's life? He seems nice.
I want to take them apart. We all have baggage. Yeah, well, my baggage doesn't try and kill me every 5 minutes.
Scott Pilgrim versus the world.
Next time, we don't date the girl with 11 evil ex-boyfriends.
Seven.
Oh, that's not that bad.